Dakota has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
My fascination with the Manhattan Project has confronted me with a moral question more than once. Was it right to have dropped the bomb on Nagasaki? Was it right to have dropped the bomb at all? I don't think we can answer that, not with any satisfaction. We'll never know the counterfactual alternate universe in which we do not drop the bomb, twice, on those cities and with that timing. But one thing is certain. Major General Leslie R. Groves, Jr., Secretary of War Henry L. Stimson, and at an arm's length, new President Harry S. Truman all believed that Japan would not surrender unless forced to, confronted with the realization that not only could the war not be won, the Japanese were already under this impression, but that surrender was the only option for survival at all. The Americans had ample evidence to suggest that Japan would indeed fight until the last man. There was, even after the bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki and the invasion by Soviet troops in Manchuria, still a Japanese cabinet member who looked at the prospect of complete annihilation rather than surrender as some act of magnificent grave duty, asking, would it not be wondrous for this whole nation to be destroyed like a beautiful flower? Another data point is the remarkable story of Hiro Onoda, a Japanese soldier who kept fighting for his homeland Japan for 29 years after World War II ended. Only in 1974 did he emerge from the Philippine jungle, having for the previous three decades waged a murderous guerrilla insurgency in support of Imperial Japan. Was this the sort of resolve the United States and its allies were facing? Does this justify the dropping of the bomb? We still don't know. So on today's Saturday Matinee, we bring you an episode from the beautifully crafted podcast Conflicted. It's the story of that one Japanese soldier, Hiro Onoda, and what happened to Japan in the three decades Onoda spent fighting for it. I hope you enjoy. While you're listening, be sure to search for and follow Conflicted, a history podcast. We put a link in the show notes to make it easy for you.
Hello and welcome to Conflicted, the history podcast where we talk about the struggles that shaped us, the tough questions that they pose, and why we should care about any of it. Conflicted is a member of the Evergreen Podcasts Network. And as always, I'm your host, Zach Cornwell. Today's episode is taking us to a time and place that I will never stop being fascinated with, Japan during the Second World War. Now, usually, the topics that we do on this show tend to be pretty large in scope, huge conflicts or pivotal events. But this episode is going to be a much smaller, much more personal story. Today, we're going to be looking at the life of Hiro Onoda, the Japanese soldier who continued fighting for 30 years after the end of World War II. Now, odds are, if you're a fan of World War II history, you've probably heard about this guy before. Hiro Onoda is the most famous example of the Japanese holdout, a post-war phenomenon where isolated pockets of the Japanese Imperial Army refused to surrender, believing, or perhaps hoping, that the war had not truly ended. In 1944, Onoda was deployed to a tiny island in the Philippines to fight against the American army. And he did not emerge from that jungle until 1974, ostensibly unaware that World War II was over. In that time, he murdered something like 30 people, believing he was fighting for an empire that no longer existed. Now, Onoda's story has already been told ad nauseum in a variety of mediums, from podcasts to feature films to historical fiction. The celebrated director Werner Herzog even wrote a book about him in 2021. There's just something about this topic that continues to fascinate, to enthrall, to beggar belief. But the story we're going to tell today is not just about one sad soldier in the jungle. Because while Onoda's life is certainly fascinating in a vacuum, it is much more interesting when juxtaposed against what was happening at home in Japan. While Onoda was languishing, surviving, and killing in the wilderness, his country was undergoing a radical transformation. Under the watchful, imperious eye of American occupiers, the land of the rising sun completely jettisoned its national identity and remade itself into something new. But while Japan was racing towards an uncertain future, Hiro Onoda was standing still. And that fundamental tension is the heart of this episode. A soldier who could not fathom defeat, fighting for a nation that was embracing it. At its core, this is a story about losing, what it means to lose, how we choose to deal with it or not deal with it, how we accept defeat or reject it, how we can believe in an idea so deeply, so fiercely, only to find out that it was all just an illusion, a mirage. This story also presents challenges of authenticity and truth. Most, if not all, accounts of Hiro Onoda's story draw exclusively from his autobiography, which he wrote with the aid of a ghostwriter shortly after his return from the Philippines in 1974. He is the very definition of an unreliable narrator, and anyone who could corroborate his version of events is long dead. But in a way, that's par for the course with this kind of stuff. At the end of the day, history is a locked room. We know the truth is in there. We know it exists right behind the door. But short of someone inventing a time machine, the past is inaccessible, and we can never truly step inside. All we can do is find little keyholes, little cracks and vantage points and narrow perspectives that with time and persistence can help us assemble an impressionist portrait of the truth. In Hiro Onoda's story, there are very few keyholes. And his autobiography, as flawed and biased as it is, forms the backbone of this episode. But that said, I've tried to approach it with a healthy degree of skepticism, an honesty, and factual mitigation, and hopefully you'll enjoy the results. So, with all that said, let's jump right in. Welcome to Hiro Onoda and the Surrender of Japan. It's February 20th, 1974. We're alone in the jungle, on a tiny island in the Philippines. There are 7,641 islands in the Philippines, that ancient, labyrinthine archipelago just north of Australia. So many islands, in fact, that you could visit a new one every single day for the next 20 years, and you still wouldn't have seen them all. But this island, our island, is called Lubang. That's L-U-B-A-N-G, Lubang. Although it is located just 61 nautical miles from the capital city of Manila, Lubang feels like another planet. Life is hard here. The 10,000 people who call the island home survive by hauling up fishing nets or working their fingers raw in the rice fields. Poverty is a fact of life. Still, Lubang is undeniably beautiful. Like an emerald lodged in a slate of turquoise, the island's jungle rises above the Pacific waves, ringed with beaches as white as powdered sugar. And as you move deeper into the interior, the sound of the ocean recedes, replaced by screaming crickets and chattering birds. Under the dense canopy, the air is thick as soup, swimming with mosquitoes and the aroma of rotting leaves. An entire ecosystem, growing and decaying in endless cycles. But tonight, there is something in this jungle that does not belong. A 25-year-old Japanese tourist named Norio Suzuki stumbles through the jungle, slipping on wet leaves and carrying a heavy backpack. After 4 days of trekking across Lubang, Suzuki is tired and hot and sweaty and uncomfortable, but he is happy. He might be very far from home, but he is right where he wants to be. Norio Suzuki was the kind of person that you can find in every airport lounge in the world. Always moving, always chatting, possessed by an insatiable wanderlust, and physically incapable of staying in one place for more than a few days. Back home in Japan, young guys like Suzuki were expected to put on a tie every morning and ride a train to a job they hated, to flatter their bosses, drink until dawn, and then do it all over again. But Suzuki didn't want any of that. He wanted to travel, to wander, to see the world. He wanted stamps on his passport, not money in his bank account. And so, he left. Suzuki dropped out of college, bought a plane ticket, and put Japan in the rear view. Over the next few years, he traveled to more than 40 different countries, seeking out bigger and bigger adventures. Before long, Suzuki was describing himself as a quote-unquote explorer, like some kind of Japanese Indiana Jones. And there were many items on Suzuki's bucket list, but three things in particular sat right at the top. Number one, he wanted to see a giant panda in the wilds of China. Number two, he wanted to find a real-life Yeti, an abominable snowman in the Himalayas. And finally, number three, Suzuki wanted to locate the infamous Japanese soldier, Hiro Onoda. It had been almost 30 years since the Empire of Japan's calamitous defeat in World War II. 30 years since a pair of atomic bombs turned Hiroshima, Nagasaki, and 200,000 people to ash. And on August 15, 1945, when Emperor Hirohito's voice crackled across the airwaves, announcing his plan to surrender unconditionally to the Allies, the Japanese people could hardly endure the psychic shock. Their world ended that day, and for better or worse, a new one began. But for millions of Japanese soldiers scattered across the Pacific, the news of their nation's defeat was slow to proliferate. Eventually, most of them went home aboard American repatriation ships, but some never got the message. Others refused to believe that the Japanese Empire would ever surrender, dismissing the entire premise as Allied propaganda. And so, they kept fighting. For weeks, months, years, decades, scattered pockets of fanatical Japanese soldiers fought their own guerrilla war against a world that had passed them by, immune to reason and allergic to defeat. Before long, the phenomenon of the Japanese holdout was born, capturing the imagination of people the world over. By 1960, most of the holdouts had been killed, captured, or convinced to surrender, and anyone still missing was presumed dead. But then, in 1972, a stunning report emerged from the Philippines. On the tiny, flyspeck island of Lubang, local police had clashed with a pair of Japanese soldiers, killing one of them in a shootout. The dead man was identified as Private First Class Kinshichi Kozuka, but the second man had vanished back into the jungle. Based on wartime records, this second soldier was Lieutenant Hiro Onoda, a Special Forces Commando and intelligence officer. Onoda had been declared dead back in 1959, so his sudden reappearance caused a flurry of interest back in Japan. Somehow, Onoda had managed to survive all this time. And even more implausibly, he was apparently convinced that World War II was still going on. Onoda had managed to elude the American Army, Philippine police, and island patrols for years. In short, he was a ghost. Unkillable, untrackable, untraceable. It was a challenge that proved irresistible to the stir-crazy college dropout, Norio Suzuki. 18 months later, he was on a plane to Manila, then a ferry to Lubang, with a brand new camera, camping gear, and a bag of flashbulbs in tow. The giant panda and the abominable snowman would have to wait. Suzuki was going to track down a very different kind of living legend. When he first arrived on Lubang, Suzuki began to understand the grip that Onoda held on the local population. The elusive lieutenant was a hero back in Japan, an amusing, anachronistic novelty. But here on the island, he was a terror, a monster in the dark, a literal serial killer. Over the last three decades, as many as 30 people or more had been murdered by the ghost in the jungle. Dozens of fathers, brothers, nephews, and sons, shot, hacked, decapitated, or all of the above. As Suzuki walked through the villages on Lubang, he would have noticed an abnormally high number of people limping along on one leg. Apparently, Onoda preferred to aim for the kneecaps or the groin. But still, Suzuki was undeterred. By hook or by crook, he was going to bring the lieutenant back to civilization. And so, in the second week of February, he took a deep breath and entered the jungle. 4 days later, after countless mosquito bites and several sleepless nights, Suzuki found what he was looking for. On the evening of February 20th, 1974, Suzuki was building a fire by a river on Lubang. The crickets were screaming, the water was churning, but above the jungle cacophony, Suzuki heard a voice call out to him. A voice speaking not in Filipino, but in Japanese. It was uncertain, quiet, the voice of a person who had not spoken to another human being in months. Slowly, Suzuki turned around. A shape was standing behind him, small and sinewy, coiled tight as a spring. Suzuki's eyes grew wide. He could see a patchy, half-rotten uniform, lean, leathery muscles, and a polished rifle pointed directly at his chest. Through the choking panic, Suzuki peered into the dusk at the apparition. It was hard to see clearly in the waning light, but this thing, this person, this man was unmistakably a Japanese soldier. And there was only one Japanese soldier left alive on Lubang. This was, this had to be, Hiro Onoda. Fear hit Norio Suzuki like a wave. He started shaking, trembling. His mind might have flooded with thoughts of one-legged men, red-eyed widows, and farmers buried without their heads. The rifle was still pointed at his chest, and Suzuki realized that if he didn't do something fast, he was going to die too. So, he did the first thing that came to mind, the only thing that made sense in the moment. He dropped everything, stood up straight, and gave the soldier a salute. "I'm Japanese," Suzuki stammered. I'm Japanese. The soldier paused, his head whipped from side to side as if looking for a trap. And then, in a quiet, hollow voice, he asked a question. Quote, "Did you come from the Japanese government?" "No," Suzuki answered. "I'm a tourist. I'm just a tourist." The soldier narrowed his eyes, his gaze corrosive with suspicion. Suzuki asked, quote, "Are you Onoda-san?" "Yeah," the soldier answered. "I'm Onoda." Suzuki caught his breath and ventured, quote, "I know that you've had a long, hard time. The war is over. Won't you come back to Japan with me?" "No," answered Onoda. "I won't go back. For me, the war hasn't ended." Suzuki's mind reeled at Onoda's resolve. For 30 long years, he'd been stranded on this island, waging a private, pointless war for an empire that no longer existed. He'd missed so many things, lost so much time. In a sense, Onoda was the last prisoner of war, a prisoner of his own mind, trapped forever in 1945. And yet now, still, with living proof of the war's end standing right in front of him, Onoda refused to go home. "Why?" asked Suzuki. Onoda replied, "You wouldn't understand." Over the next few hours, Suzuki tried to understand. He invited a very suspicious Onoda back to his campsite and offered him a cigarette. And under a moonless black sky, in the middle of the Philippine jungle, the men talked all night. And Onoda told his life story to a 20-something tourist. It all began 29 years, 1 month, and 19 days earlier, when he first arrived on Lubang Island. It's December 31st, 1944, and the Empire of Japan is collapsing. At the peak of its expansion in early 1942, writes historian John Dower, Japan bestrode Asia like a colossus, one foot planted in the mid-Pacific, the other deep in the interior of China. Its ambitious grasp reaching north to the Aleutian Islands and south to the western colonial enclaves of Southeast Asia. Japan's Greater East Asia Co-Prosperity Sphere briefly embraced the Netherlands East Indies, French Indochina, the British colonial possessions of Burma, Malaya, and Hong Kong, and America's Philippine colony. There was talk of reaching further to take India, Australia, possibly even Hawaii. Banzai cries of glory to the emperor's holy war and the invincibility of his loyal soldiers and sailors pierced the heavens in myriad places at home and overseas. End quote. But now, just 3 years after the surprise attack on Pearl Harbor, it is all falling apart. The Americans were quick to recover from the shock of Pearl Harbor, and before long, the shipyards of North America were ringing with the sounds of hammers and rivets and cutters. Planes roared into the sky, battleships plunged into the sea, and Marines leapt into landing craft, all burning with a righteous hatred for the little island chain that had dared to throw such an audacious sucker punch. Japan had built its empire in the blink of an eye, and they lost it just as fast. With the Americans on the offensive, disaster followed disaster in the Pacific theater. Outgunned, outmanned, and outstrategized by the U.S. Navy, the Japanese fleet died a slow, agonizing death in a series of decisive battles at places like Midway and Leyte Gulf. By the end of 1944, the once invincible Japanese Navy was turning to rust at the bottom of the ocean, unable to stop the relentless Americans from establishing complete control over the Pacific. And the effects were felt very fast. Across the Japanese Empire, supplies stopped flowing. Factories stopped producing. Food stopped arriving. And like vengeful hands squeezing a pair of lungs, American forces wrapped themselves around the Empire of Japan, suffocating its dominion, one beach, one reef, one airstrip at a time. As the bodies and desperation mounted, both sides learned to despise the other with a cruel and feral intensity. What U.S. Marine Eugene Sledge called a, quote, "brutish, primitive hatred." In Europe, remembered U.S. reporter Ernie Pyle, We felt that our enemies, horrible and deadly as they were still people. But in the Pacific, I soon gathered that Japanese were looked upon as something subhuman and repulsive, the way some people feel about mice and cockroaches. 1942 became 1943, became 1944. And as the American war machine inched closer and closer to the home islands, the Japanese sought to reinforce key staging areas in the Pacific to try and slow the American sprint to a painful crawl. And one of the most important bulwarks in that defensive perimeter was the Philippine Island chain, a U.S. territory that Japan had seized very early in the war, just hours after the attack on Pearl Harbor. But now, American warships had returned to take back what was theirs. By the time shells started falling on the Philippines, any serious hope of winning the war against the United States had disappeared beneath the waves. Defeat was all but inevitable. But the militarists and the bureaucrats who controlled the levers of power back in Tokyo were not content to surrender in despair. After all, an arm that can lift a white flag can also lift a sword. And they were determined to make the United States pay dearly for every grain of sand and every grove of trees in the South Pacific, to drown American morale in an ocean of blood. And so, small numbers of Japanese soldiers specializing in guerrilla warfare and clandestine insurgency were dispatched to the Philippines to conduct operations against U.S. troops. And one of these soldiers was Lieutenant Hiro Onoda. On December 31st, 1944, Onoda is standing on the deck of a Japanese ship called the Saifuku Maru as it steams through the serpentine waterways of the Philippines. He is a young man, only about 23 years old. In photographs from the time period, Onoda looks confident, intelligent, and serious. His face is smooth as porcelain, and his taut, wiry frame stands just 5'4" tall. But despite his diminutive stature, he is extremely well-trained. Scattered across the Pacific, there are millions of soldiers fighting, killing, and dying for the Japanese Emperor Hirohito, the Son of Heaven. And 900,000 of those soldiers are here, in the Philippines. And each of them has a part to play, a specific role in the immense machinery of the war effort. Some of them haul ammunition, or dig ditches, or guard prisoners, but Hiro Onoda is different. He is, in his own words, quote, special, an elite soldier with a, quote, special mission. And that special mission is here, on a tiny island rising out of the gloom. As Onoda remembered decades later, quote, the island of Lubang began to appear over the distant horizon. Gradually, it grew larger, and before long, I could make out the individual palm leaves through my binoculars. There were mountains, but it looked as though the highest could not be more than 1,500 to 1,800 feet high. My first impression of Lubang was that it was going to be difficult terrain for guerrilla warfare. End quote. No, it was not an impressive theater of operations, but Onoda was a loyal soldier. He would go where he was told, without a word of complaint or a whisper of doubt. His orders, which he had received a few days earlier at 14th Army Headquarters in Manila, had been clear and direct. The first thing for you to do, his intelligence officer had told him, is destroy the Lubang airfield and the pier at the harbor. Should the enemy land and try to use the airfield, destroy their planes and kill their crews. As Onoda leapt off the boat and his boots sank into the sugar-white sand of Lubang, it felt like a fresh start. Tomorrow, 1944, would become 1945. As Onoda remembered thinking on that first day, quote, a new year and a new job. Onoda's job, as he understood it, was fairly straightforward. He was supposed to link up with the Japanese garrison on the island and lead them in a coordinated guerrilla insurgency against the local islanders as well as the American troops that would eventually land to retake Lubang. When they came, and they most certainly would, Onoda was going to bleed the Marines dry. He was going to confuse them, to scare them, to kill them while they slept, to engage in what he called, quote, secret warfare. It was what he had been trained to do, and although he had never killed a man, Onoda relished the opportunity to make his family and his country proud, to protect his father, his mother, his brother, and his sisters back home in Japan. In his mind, every American soldier stuck dealing with Lieutenant Onoda on Lubang was an American soldier who was not marching towards Tokyo, bayoneting, burning, and raping as they went. He had to keep them tied down, keep them distracted, keep them here. But thankfully, he did not have to do it alone. There were just over 150 Japanese soldiers on Lubang when Onoda first arrived. The best outfit in the whole Japanese army, an officer back in Manila had declared. But when he finally met them, Onoda realized that the comment had been sarcastic. The Japanese garrison on Lubang was absolutely pathetic. The worst of the worst, the dregs of the dregs. Cowards or fanatics, or worse, cowards pretending to be fanatics. I had been sent to this island to fight, Onoda remembered, only to find that the troops I was supposed to lead were a bunch of good-for-nothings. When Onoda tried to organize the men, they ignored him. When he tried to inspire them, they laughed at him. None of them had training in guerrilla warfare, and they had no interest in learning. As Onoda remembered, quote, "They did not even take me seriously. My nickname among them was Noda Shoyu, the name of a famous brand of soy sauce. The Noda came from my name, and Shoyu was suggested by Shoyi, the word for second lieutenant. The meaning was that I was not the main course, only a bit of seasoning." End quote. In other words, he was irrelevant, unimportant, a joke. Initially, Onoda hoped that he might be able to gain their trust, earn their respect, but that would take time. And as it happened, they were out of time. On January 3rd, just 72 hours after he had arrived, Onoda peered out at the sea through his binoculars and saw, quote, "the enemy fleet." And what a fleet. As carefully as I could, I counted the vessels. There were 2 battleships, 4 aircraft carriers, 4 cruisers, and enough light cruisers and destroyers to make up a total of 37 or 38 warships. What astonished me most, however, was not this awesome armada, but the host of troop transports that followed it. There must have been nearly 150 of them. As if that were not enough, the sea was literally peppered with landing craft, more than I could possibly count. End quote. The American reconquest of the Philippines had officially begun. Desperately, Onoda tried to convince the garrison that they had to prepare. They had to move their supplies up the mountain, conserve their food, and prepare for a long, ugly, protracted fight. They had to stop thinking like occupiers and start thinking like insurgents. Fighting the Americans head-to-head was not only pointless, it was wasteful. But unfortunately, Onoda's warnings fell on deaf ears. As the weeks dragged on, and the waters around Lubang filled with American warships, discipline broke down completely. It was infuriating, Onoda remembered. There I was, powerless, with a disorderly pack of troops, none of whom understood the first thing about the kind of guerrilla war that we would soon be engaged in. End quote. As they sat around their campfires, some of the Japanese soldiers insisted that the Americans would not attack Lubang at all. It was too small, too isolated, of little importance or strategic value. Why would they waste their time with a flyspeck island 6 miles wide and 18 miles long? Why are we here, then? Onoda might have said under his breath. In the Pacific War, size had never been a marker of strategic value. The Americans had spent hundreds of lives on scraps of coral barely bigger than a football field. And besides, Lubang was too close to the all-important capital of Manila. As long as the Japanese held Lubang, it was a threat. Sooner or later, the Americans were going to land. And on February 28, 1945, they did. The Marines that leapt from the landing craft and waded through the surf were monsters. Huge, hairy, and well-fed, they were like mountain trolls with semi-automatic weapons. And a blistering naval bombardment announced their arrival. "My whole insides shook with vibrations," Onoda remembered. The coast was covered with dust and smoke. Palm trees and parts of houses flew through the air. End quote. In the end, the garrison on Lubang never stood a chance. Some of the Japanese officers organized a suicidal frontal assault, and they were quickly cut down by the Marines. The rest scattered into the jungle, hunted by mop-up squads and hounded by bullets. Amidst the carnage and confusion, Hiro Onoda searched for survivors. And as he roamed the jungle, he saw something that left a deep impression. Quote, "I saw American chewing gum wrappers by the side of the road. In one place, a wad of chewing gum was sticking to the leaf of a weed. Here we were, holding on for dear life, and these guys were chewing gum while they fought. I was more sad than angry. The chewing gum tinfoil told me just how miserably we had been beaten." End quote. Hiro Onoda turned 24 in the jungle, but he felt much, much older. He was right about the Americans. No one had listened, but he was right. They came, and they conquered, and they killed. But he didn't feel smart, he didn't feel vindicated, he just felt alone and impotent. He had failed to destroy the airfield. He had failed to destroy the pier. He had failed his mission in every way but one. Back in Manila, 3 months earlier, a lieutenant general had been at his initial mission briefing. That day, the general said something to Onoda that would be his North Star, his compass, his bright and burning purpose for the next 30 years. "You are absolutely forbidden to die by your own hand," the general said to him. "It may take 3 years, it may take 5, but whatever happens, we will come back for you. Until then, so long as you have one soldier, you are to continue to lead them. You may have to live on coconuts. If that's the case, live on coconuts. But under no circumstances are you to give up your life voluntarily." End quote. The words became seared into Onoda's gray matter. as long as you have one soldier. It was a command, a conditional, one that Onoda found himself hard-pressed to fulfill in the aftermath of the American assault. After all, who was even left to lead at this point? Everyone else had been killed, captured, or was too afraid to fight. Well, as it turned out, the Lubang garrison may have been beaten and broken, but not everyone was dead. Not yet. It's August 14th, 1945, the last night of World War II. We're in Tokyo, the capital city of the Empire of Japan. 5 years earlier, Tokyo had been a vibrant metropolis, teeming with promise and prosperity. This was a city drenched in history, with thousands of stories etched into every garden, temple, and alleyway. 12 million people lived here. But now, it is a graveyard, an ashtray. American air raids, dropping napalm, white phosphorus, and incendiary bombs have turned Tokyo into the skeleton of a city. Everything is flat and dead, as if some giant etch-a-sketch had simply wiped the buildings away. Streets that used to hum with parades and patriotic fervor are haunted by starving kids and feral dogs. Millions are homeless. But despite the devastation, there is at least one building left standing in the heart of Tokyo, and that is the Imperial Palace, home of the Japanese Emperor Hirohito. In the last months of the war, the Japanese archipelago was a target-rich environment for the American Air Force, a bomber's paradise of bone-dry wood and crowded neighborhoods. With the Japanese Navy destroyed, U.S. planes and carriers could reach any corner of the home islands with complete impunity. But there was one building, one target, that they absolutely could not touch. The Imperial Palace was considered strictly off-limits. Not necessarily because of its beauty or historical significance, but because of its occupant. For the Japanese people, Emperor Hirohito is a living god, the soul of the nation rendered into flesh and blood. Even the most rabid Air Force commanders know that a direct attack on the emperor would be extremely unwise. And so the Imperial Palace rises up from the ash, as insulated from consequences as its divine occupant. But tonight, on August 14th, those consequences are coming home to roost. Deep beneath the palace, somewhere in its maze of hallways and antechambers, a makeshift recording studio is being prepared. Wires are connected, electricity is routed, and a microphone is placed delicately in the center of the room. Just before midnight, a man enters the recording studio, flanked by a coterie of technicians and attendants. He is exhausted and somber. He wears round glasses to compensate for his bad eyesight. At 44 years old, Emperor Hirohito does not look or feel much like a living god. The emperor sits in front of the microphone and prepares to read the document that is laid out before him. It's only 652 words, about 4.5 minutes of recording time, but it will alter the destiny of millions of people around the world. This document is an address to the subjects of the emperor, an official declaration informing them that Japan is going to surrender unconditionally to the Allies. Surrender had not been Hirohito's first choice. If we hold out long enough in this war, he once told an advisor, we might be able to win. But then, two things happened. On August 6th, the United States erased the city of Hiroshima from the map with an atomic weapon. The next day, August 7th, the Soviet Union declared war on Japan. This was checkmate. Game over. As one imperial advisor remembered, quote, I felt the atomic bomb struck me hard on one cheek. And immediately afterwards, the Soviet declaration of war hit me with full force on the other cheek. Emperor Hirohito had to make a hard decision, one historian wrote. Either keep on fighting and ensure that his entire country is completely obliterated, or agree to an unconventional surrender which would almost certainly ensure that his whole cabinet and most likely himself would be tried as war criminals. End quote. In the end, Hirohito chose to gamble on the mercy of the Americans. As he told his cabinet, quote, all of us now must bear the unbearable and tolerate the intolerable. End quote. And so, just before midnight on August 14th, Hirohito takes a breath, leans close to the microphone, and reads. His voice is wobbly, unsure of itself. He stumbles and speaks in a stiff, clipped cadence, but he gets through it. The audio technicians check the recording and have it pressed onto two phonograph records. Tomorrow at noon, the recording will be broadcast on Japanese state radio. And for most of the emperor's subjects, it will be the first time they have ever heard his voice. But tonight, not everyone in the Japanese high command is willing to bear the unbearable. While the emperor is recording his address down in the imperial catacombs, an armed coup is unfolding up above. A battalion of renegade soldiers, enraged at the humiliating prospect of surrender, has decided to overthrow Hirohito's government and stop the recording from being broadcast. Their goal is simple: to intercept the message and destroy it. The Son of Heaven, they thought, had clearly gone insane. Didn't he know? Didn't he understand what would happen if U.S. troops were allowed to enter the nation victorious and unopposed? The Americans would take their revenge, their horrible, blood-soaked revenge. Men butchered, children enslaved, women raped. The Son of Heaven himself dangling from a noose. No, it was better to stand and fight to the death, no matter how many atomic bombs they dropped or cities they destroyed. In a way, it would be poetic. One nation, one race snuffed out in a last act of glorious sacrifice. Would it not be wondrous, one Japanese general mused, for this whole nation to be destroyed like a beautiful flower? The ringleaders of the coup moved quickly. They cut the phone lines, surrounded the palace, and killed anyone who got in their way. With bayonets gleaming, they swarmed the hallways and corridors, desperately searching for the phonograph recordings that would bring an end to the war. They searched and searched and searched, but in the yawning blackness of the catacombs, the conspirators could not find what they were looking for. And in the end, the coup died on the vine. Within hours, the loyalists and the Japanese army took back control of the palace, disarmed the renegades, and delivered the recordings to the broadcast stations. At 11:59 a.m. the next day, millions of Japanese gathered around their radios in anticipation of the historic address. As Ian Toll writes, quote, "In outlying rural communities, there might only be one radio in a village, so the entire community gathered in an outdoor space, a street, a park, a school playground. In the cities, neighborhood associations connected radios to loudspeakers. Friends and neighbors gathered in private homes. Many workers came home so that they could listen to the broadcast with their families. In factories, in offices, in schools, in military barracks, the Japanese gathered around the radios, solemn and reverent, with heads bowed and hats in hand." End quote. And when the clock struck noon, Hirohito's voice came over the airwaves. It was a short speech, and after a brief introduction, Hirohito got right to the point. Quote, "Despite the best that has been done by everyone, the gallant fighting of the military and naval forces, the diligence and assiduity of our servants of the state, and the devoted service of our 100 million people, the war situation has developed not necessarily to Japan's advantage, while the general trends of the world have all turned against her interest. Moreover, the enemy has begun to employ a new and most cruel bomb, the power of which to do damage is indeed incalculable, taking the toll of many innocent lives. Should we continue to fight, it would result in an ultimate collapse and obliteration of the Japanese nation." End quote. The initial reactions to the emperor's address, known to history as the Jewel Voice broadcast, were mixed. Some wept, some laughed, some were catatonic with shock, but most people were just confused. "The language was archaic," writes Ian Toll, "an obscure dialect of the ancient Japanese imperial court. Even highly educated Japanese found the speech cryptic and perplexing. Those who had received less schooling were completely baffled." End quote. But despite the confusion and the terrible audio quality, the core idea of the emperor's message still managed to break through. As one Navy lieutenant remembered, quote, "Even though we couldn't follow the words exactly, we knew what the message was, what he was telling us, and we were frightened and yet relieved." End quote. From its epicenter in Tokyo, the emperor's message radiated out into the world like an earthquake. Across the home islands, over the oceans and continents, from New York to Paris, Cape Town to Cleveland, Moscow to Manila, Hirohito's words may have sounded timid, his phrasing esoteric, but the message was loud and clear. The war was over. This monstrous conflict, this global tragedy, was finally, finally over.
Newsmen rushed to nearby telephones with the electrifying story. A hurricane of unrestrained joy sweeps through every part of a war-sick world, from the rice paddies of China to the streets of every city throughout the Americas. Manila, The Japs are instructed by General Douglas MacArthur, Allied Supreme Commander, to send a delegation to him for his first orders to Emperor Hirohito. Led by General Kawabe, they are escorted to American headquarters.
But there was at least one corner of the war-sick world where the Emperor's words went unheard. 2,000 miles south of Tokyo, on Lubang Island, Lieutenant Hiro Onoda was deep in the jungle, planning a guerrilla resistance against the Americans and their Filipino collaborators. The months since the amphibious assault on Lubang in late February had been difficult. Driven into the mountains, hunted by patrols, and racked with hunger pangs, Onoda came to the grim realization that he actually had no idea how to survive in the wilderness. All his training, all his skill and expertise, it meant nothing out here. I could only perform those functions of guerrilla warfare that resemble the work of a spy, Onoda remembered. The techniques I had been taught were of little use to me. I had learned to tap telephone lines, open letters surreptitiously, and undo handcuffs, but these all involved there being a lot of other people around. Here in the mountains, it was far more important to know how to build a fire without making much smoke. End quote. Fear was a constant companion, as ubiquitous as the screaming crickets and the distant shouts of American patrols. Onoda felt alone and scared and, worst of all, impotent. He was unable to complete his mission and yet forbidden to die. Someday, he knew, the Japanese army would come back in force and retake the island. The Americans would be driven out of the Philippines entirely, hounded back across the Pacific to their own shores. And when that happened, what would Onoda say to his superiors? That he had hid in the mountains like a rat, waiting out the storm? No, he had to do something. He had to survive. As long as there was blood in his veins and breath in his lungs, he could be an instrument of the Emperor's holy war. Thankfully, Onoda soon learned that he was not so alone after all. One day, shortly after the American assault, Onoda stumbled upon a pair of surviving Japanese soldiers in the jungle. They were dirty and haggard, but he recognized both of them instantly. Their names were Corporal Shoichi Shimada and Private Kinshichi Kozuka. Whereas many of the other soldiers on Lubang had been cruel and dismissive, calling him soy sauce and laughing off his warnings, Onoda knew these men to be brave, reliable, and filled with what he called, quote, essential goodness. Or at least he hoped that they were. After all, when it comes to companions in a life or death situation, beggars can't be choosers. Now, before we go any further, let's take a second and really commit these names to memory, because these two men are going to be absolutely crucial to our story going forward. Shimada and Kozuka. Now, sometimes, admittedly, Japanese names are a little difficult for us in the West, but I think it's important to really internalize them now. So once again, that's Shimada, S-H-I-M-A-D-A, and Kozuka, K-O-Z-U-K-A. Shimada and Kozuka. And as they huddled around the campfire, speaking with hushed voices in the flickering dark, Onoda, Shimada, and Kozuka shared their lives with each other, who they were before the war, their hopes, their dreams, their flaws and failures. And little by little, sprouts of trust began to emerge from their conversations. Shimada was a country boy, a farmer's son from rural Japan. Years of working the fields had hardened his body into a slab of coiled muscle. He was tall, he was strong, he was tough as an ox and twice as loyal. But despite his imposing physique, Shimada was a glowing presence, a veritable chatterbox. He always had something to talk about, Onoda recalled, and he took the lead when we sat around chatting in the evening. Shimada laughed, he smiled, and he told stories. He talked about his family back home, his beautiful wife, his little girl, and the baby that was on the way. Like all good fathers, Shimada loved talking about his daughter. He couldn't wait for the day when he could go home and burst through the door with medals jingling on his uniform, when he could scoop his little girl up in his arms, kiss his wife while dinner bubbled on the stove, and listen to the new baby cooing in the crib. It was a good life, a life worth fighting for, and smiling Shimada was a breath of fresh air for a group in desperate need of some optimism. Then there was the second man, Kozuka. If smiling Shimada was a fountain of words, Kozuka was an aquifer of thoughts and feelings, locked deep beneath the stoic exterior. A small man with a small voice, quiet Kozuka was more of a listener than a talker. He was the introvert to Shimada's extrovert. Kozuka was very reticent, Onoda remembered. Only rarely did he speak without being spoken to. On those occasions when he did loosen up, he talked with great feeling about the days before he entered the army, but even then, he had trouble expressing himself. I gathered that his family was fairly well off. He said he had owned a racehorse. End quote. But as the men talked more and more, the initial awkwardness began to melt away. In this remote, threatening jungle, crawling with ants, centipedes, and Americans who wanted them dead, the three Japanese soldiers entered a kind of covenant. And like metal shavings around a magnet, the men drew together in purpose. Onoda, the leader, Shimada, the optimist, and Kozuka, the introvert. One day, Japanese reinforcements would arrive. It might be 5 days, 5 weeks, 5 months, or 5 years, but the emperor's armies were indomitable and implacable, guided by heaven and filled with the samurai spirit. In time, they would return to drown the Americans like dogs in the surf. But until that day, Onoda and his men would endure, they would resist, and they would fight. Rejuvenated by companionship and renewed purpose, Onoda, Kozuka, and Shimada went to work. They meticulously cataloged what remained of their food supplies. The rice would be gone in a matter of weeks, but Lubang Island was rich in natural food sources. Bananas and coconuts fell from the trees, iguanas and chickens scuttled in the brush, even cows and water buffalo could be found in the open fields. The trio of soldiers moved from place to place, always covering their tracks, never staying in one spot for more than a few days. In the distance, they could hear the occasional plunk of mortar fire or the crack of a gunshot. The American cleanup squads were killing the other groups of Japanese survivors, slowly and systematically. But as the days passed and the weeks went on, Onoda heard fewer and fewer gunshots. Eventually, they stopped entirely. After the middle of August, Onoda observed, the patrols stopped coming. They must be trying to starve us out, thought Onoda, waiting for us to die in the jungle, to go mad with malnutrition and hunger and rot, and just when we can't take it anymore. When we come running out of the jungle like crazy men, begging for a thimble of rice, they'll kill us. Or capture us. Or worse. Well, Onoda decided that is not going to happen. They will never, ever find us. But one day, in the closing months of 1945, Onoda, Shimada, and Kozuka heard a sound overhead. It was a tremendous whine, a diesel roar that cut through the jungle calm. The three men looked up. And through the dappled canopy, silhouetted against a clear blue sky, they saw the unmistakable shape of an American B-17 heavy bomber. So, Onoda thought, they've decided to burn us out, to flatten the jungle and us along with it. And sure enough, the bomber's bay doors opened like an enormous mouth, spewing its payload down onto the island. Onoda and his men braced for the inevitable impact, the violent tremors that would collapse their lungs and pop their organs like grapes. But instead of an explosion, all they heard was a soft rustling. It wasn't bombs that were falling on Lubang. It was paper. Hundreds and hundreds of paper leaflets fluttering to the ground like snow. And with trembling hands, Onoda picked one up, blinked through the sweat, and read the words. The message was written in broad, black strokes, clear as day, in Japanese. The leaflet said, quote, "The war ended on August 15th. Come down from the mountains." The hairs on Onoda's neck stood up like troops on parade. He was well-versed in the art of propaganda and subterfuge. It had been a cornerstone of his commando training. When you cannot break an army with bullets or bombs, you break them with ideas. You infect their minds with doubt, contradictions, even hope. Onoda and the other men analyzed the content of the leaflet. Quote, "We gathered together and considered whether the orders printed on the leaflet were genuine. On the front were printed the surrender orders from General Yamashita of the 14th Area Army and a directive from the Chief of Staff. On the back was a map of Lubang, on which the place where the leaflets were dropped was marked with a circle." End quote. At face value, the message did appear to be legitimate. But the closer Onoda looked, the more the leaflet felt wrong. Something eerie, uncanny, like a feeling you can't explain or a memory you can't quite place. It felt unsettling, malicious even. The grammar was awkward, the semantics were clumsy, as if some American who only knew Japanese as a second language had scribbled it down in haste. A translation of a translation of a translation. No, this was all wrong. The leaflets were clearly a trick, meant to lure them into a trap. Onoda had never seen it firsthand, but the rumors of what American soldiers did to their Japanese captives had been drilled into them by their superiors and the state media. Monstrous atrocities, like something out of a horror story. As one man on Okinawa recalled after the war, quote, "We knew that if we were captured, we'd be chopped to pieces. They'd cut off our noses, our ears, chop off our fingers, and then run over our bodies with their tanks." End quote. This leaflet was obviously a lie, a forgery, a ponderous ploy by a desperate enemy. It was textbook counterinsurgency, and Onoda knew better. I could only conclude, Onadah remembered, that the leaflet was phony. The others all agreed with me. There was no doubt in our minds that this was an enemy trick. End quote. But the truth was, far away, in some crowded American intelligence office, a typist had just made a mistake. A simple printing error that had made the leaflet sound odd to Japanese ears. And if anyone noticed the error, they shrugged it off and went back to work. But that printing error would alter the course of Hiro Onoda's life. To him, the mistake was a telltale sign of American duplicity. And so, he dropped the leaflet right where he'd found it. To carry it away or discard it somewhere else might reveal their location to the enemy. And so, like phantoms, Onoda, Shimada, and Kozuka slipped back into the jungle. It's September 2nd, 1945, 2 weeks after Emperor Hirohito's solemn radio broadcast, 2 weeks since the Son of Heaven had told his subjects that the war was over. And now we are in Tokyo Bay, on the deck of an American battleship called the USS Missouri. With its gargantuan guns, towering superstructure, and 12-inch armor plating, the Missouri is an imposing instrument of war, a testament to the near limitless industrial capability of the United States. But today, the USS Missouri is not a ship, it is a stage, a carefully chosen venue for a well-planned, well-choreographed performance that will seal the fate of 70 million people. Today, the representatives of the Japanese Emperor will sign the official declaration of surrender. As they arrive at the USS Missouri, the Japanese dignitaries steel themselves to bear the unbearable, to endure the unendurable, as Hirohito had put it. All they have to do is sign on the dotted line. But each flick of the pen feels like a knife in their gut. The future remained terribly uncertain, writes historian John Dower, and the enormity of the nation's humiliation had only begun to sink in. The country's utter subjugation was reinforced by the dramatic setting of the surrender ceremony itself. The Imperial Navy had long since been demolished. Apart from a few thousand rickety planes held in reserve for suicide attacks, Japan's Air Force, not only its aircraft but its skilled pilots as well, had virtually ceased to exist. Its merchant fleet lay at the bottom of the ocean. Almost all of the country's major cities had been firebombed, and millions of the emperor's loyal subjects were homeless. The defeated imperial army was scattered throughout Asia and the islands of the Pacific Ocean, its millions of surviving soldiers starving, wounded, sick, and demoralized. But Tokyo Bay was clogged with hundreds of powerful, well-scrubbed American fighting ships. At a thunderous, theatrical moment, the sky was all but obscured by a flyby of some 400 glistening B-29 bombers, accompanied by 1,500 Navy fighter planes. The imperial soil was being desecrated by the landings of wave upon wave of well-fed, superbly equipped, supremely confident GIs, an army of occupation whose numbers in short time would surpass a quarter of a million. End quote. The Allied military occupation of Japan is about to begin. And presiding over the momentous ceremony aboard the USS Missouri, conducting this symphony of subjugation, is General Douglas MacArthur, Supreme Commander for Allied Forces in the Pacific, or SCAP for short. Towering over the Japanese delegation at 6 foot tall, General MacArthur initiates the proceedings.
It is my earnest hope, and indeed the hope of all mankind, that from this solemn occasion, a better world shall emerge out of the blood and carnage of the past. I now invite the representatives of the Emperor of Japan and the Japanese government and the Japanese Imperial General Headquarters to sign the instrument of surrender at the places indicated.
On this fine day in Tokyo Bay, General MacArthur feels like a winner, a demigod in khaki, energetic in fatigues, endowed with absolute authority. He is the man in Japan, the one who will hold this renegade nation to account and usher in peace to a mauled and mutilated hemisphere. Today, Douglas MacArthur is a winner, but he knows better than most what it means to lose. In the anguished faces of the Japanese delegation, he sees a reflection of himself. of days gone by. The rage and impotence and embarrassment and goddamn awful sting of defeat. Yes, Douglas MacArthur knows what it means to lose. 4 years earlier, in 1941, MacArthur had been tasked with the defense of the Philippines, then a U.S. territory. From the capital of Manila to the sugar-white beaches of Lubang, MacArthur's job was to guard all 7,641 of those islands from any encroachment by the Japanese Empire. And then, like a hammer to the temple, Pearl Harbor happened. In a matter of hours, the Japanese were everywhere at once. The oil slicks were still burning in Hawaii when the Japanese descended upon the Philippines. MacArthur rallied his forces, did the best he could, but the emperor's soldiers were too many, too organized, too well-equipped. And MacArthur's defense of the Philippines ended in a humiliating retreat, a nauseous midnight ride in a PT boat bound for Australia. The Philippines were lost, and he had failed. But MacArthur was proud and vain and defiant, and he vowed to retake the Philippines. "I shall return," he famously said. The U.S. Office of War Information advised against that kind of self-aggrandizing rhetoric and asked him to amend the statement to, "We shall return." But MacArthur refused. That was just the kind of person he was. As historian and biographer William Manchester writes, quote, "He was a great thundering paradox of a man, noble and ignoble, inspiring and outrageous, arrogant and shy, the best of men and the worst of men, the most protean, the most ridiculous, the most sublime. No more baffling, exasperating soldier ever wore a uniform. Flamboyant, imperious, and apocalyptic, he carried the plumage of a flamingo, could not acknowledge errors, and tried to cover up his mistakes with sly, childish tricks. Yet he was also endowed with great personal charm, a will of iron, and a soaring intellect." 2 years later, MacArthur kept his word and returned to the Philippines with the U.S. Navy at his back. He took back Manila, smoking crater that it was. He sent the Marines and landing craft that broke the garrison on Lubang. And now, in September of 1945, he is standing here on the deck of the USS Missouri, beaming with blissful vindication. The Japanese had taught him what it meant to lose, and now he was going to teach them what it meant to lose. Oh yes, General MacArthur had big plans for Japan. And what were those plans exactly? Well, the Japanese could only speculate.
What does a conquering army do with 70 million people? What does a conquering army do with the family of the Japanese soldier? Fathers. Brothers. Mothers, cousins of the soldier. What do we do with the soldiers themselves, back now in civilian clothes as part of the Japanese family? What to do with these people?
In the long, ugly history of armed conflict, defeated nations generally do not fare well under occupying armies. The Assyrians skewered their enemies on spikes. The Mongols built towers of skulls, and the Romans enslaved tribes by the hundreds. It was an old, immutable instinct to punish your enemies so brutally, so completely, that they would never, ever challenge you again. The Japanese knew history, and they knew their own history. They were afraid. What would happen to them now? In the last months of the war, the Americans had already proven what they were capable of. Swarms of bombers had burned half of Tokyo alive. Atomic weapons had flattened Hiroshima and Nagasaki into clumps of human potpourri. And now that they had complete control, full access, unfettered dominion, what was to stop the United States from taking a crimson revenge? Maybe they deserved it. Nagging at the heart of every Japanese bureaucrat, every general, every sergeant, every truck driver and radio operator was the knowledge of what they had done in places like China and Korea and Singapore. As John Dower writes, quote, "From the rape of Nanking in the opening months of the war against China to the rape of Manila in the final stages of the Pacific War, the emperor's soldiers and sailors left a trail of unspeakable cruelty and rapacity. As it turned out, they also devoured themselves. Japanese died in hopeless suicide charges, starved to death in the field, killed their own wounded rather than let them fall into enemy hands, and murdered their civilian compatriots in places such as Saipan and Okinawa." End quote. As American ships filled Tokyo Bay and propellers screamed overhead, the Japanese people were understandably apprehensive about what the future held. But in a way, they were also relieved. For months, Hirohito's government had been telling them day after day after day that they were expected to resist the Americans to the death. With sticks and spears and suicide bombs, every man, woman, and child would die, in the words of one militarist, like, quote, "shattered jewels." Good men and women, observed one Japanese writer, remained committed to collective suicide right up to the moment at which unconditional surrender was announced. Or, if not committed, at least resigned. Like their fighting men abroad, those on the home front were rarely able to imagine a future other than struggle and probable death. End quote. Through propaganda and relentless repetition, they had been, in the words of another Japanese scholar, quote, socialized for death. But the emperor's surrender had opened up a window, an escape hatch, a light at the end of the tunnel. An entire nation was going to get a second chance. As John Dower writes, quote, surrender, and by association the Allied victory, the American Army of Occupation itself, liberated them from death. Month after month, they had prepared for the worst. And then abruptly, the tension was broken. In an almost literal sense, they were given back their lives. End quote. Yes, General Douglas MacArthur did indeed have plans for Japan, but they were not intrinsically punitive. They were transformational. He saw the Japanese Empire like a patient on the operating table. There was a political cancer, a rot deep inside. And to save the body, he was going to have to cut the tumors out. It would be painful, it would be messy, but Japan was going to survive. And in time, it would thrive. As John Dower writes, quote, the Japanese would not be enslaved or destroyed as a nation, although they would lose their empire. On surrendering, the country would be placed under military occupation. Quote unquote, stern justice would be meted out to war criminals. The authority and influence of those who had, quote, deceived and misled the people of Japan into embarking on world conquest would be eliminated, quote, for all time. Just reparations in kind would be exacted. Military forces would be completely disarmed. The economy would be demilitarized but eventually permitted to return to world trade. And the government would be required to, quote, remove all obstacles to the revival and strengthening of democratic tendencies among the Japanese people, and to establish freedom of speech, religion, and thought, as well as respect for fundamental human rights. End quote. MacArthur and his lieutenants were no angels, of course. Their bigotry was palpable, their neo-colonial zeal viscous and potent. Lifting Japan back to its feet was not some act of altruism, it was a matter of national security. After all, with communism on the rise, America needed a reliable bulwark in Asia, and defeated Japan was the fresh clay that they would use to shape it. As one historian put it, quote, in the American occupation of Japan, the interests of enlightened humanitarianism and cold-blooded realpolitik were, for the most part, conveniently aligned. End quote. But ultimately, the intent of the Allied occupation was not to hurt, it was to heal, to turn an enemy into an asset, to deprogram 70 million people and give them something to live for again. It was not going to be easy, but they had to try. As historian John Dower wrote, quote, such an audacious undertaking by victors in war had no legal or historical precedent. An empire had vanished, wrote one American journalist. The world was fluid and about to be remade.
Concluding the brief history-making ceremony, General MacArthur expresses a wish.
Let us pray that peace be now restored to the world, and that God will preserve it always. These proceedings are closed.
Swarms of United States aircraft fly in formation overhead as the ceremony ends. The final United Nations victory has been won. The war is over. Peace is here.
That was the first half of the episode Hiro Onoda and the Surrender of Japan from the podcast Conflicted, a History Podcast. Be sure to search for and follow Conflicted, a History Podcast for the rest.
Moro Casino, America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends, with thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
COTA has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit rightrug.com. RITERUG.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right here, right now.